That's probably true. Probably true. So let's pray, and I'll try to rid my mind of all that stuff, and we'll get on the book of Daniel. Father, we're grateful for the opportunity to gather. We're grateful for this book, that we don't have to walk through this world blind. Lord, but you give us truth, and you give us understanding of even the end times, Lord, so as we approach these things, we don't have to walk in fear, and we don't have to walk in ignorance, Lord, but we can know what's to come, and that gives us peace while we're in it. So, Lord, would you speak as you always do through your word, bring it to life, Lord, in a way that we can understand. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. So I was super optimistic last week, thought we'd make it through chapter 2. We didn't. Hoping to make time today, but we probably won't. There's so much in here. So the book of Daniel, just briefly, I won't kind of recap the whole season that we've been in, but it is an incredibly exciting, a very important book to study in the Bible. It's both a historical book and a prophetical book, a book of end times prophecy. I think it's really important to understand the book of Daniel, to understand end times prophecy, things that are to come. The Bible doesn't have a single volume or a book called prophecy, or this is all the stuff that happens at the end, you know. So I just want to encourage you guys. Some of you I know have a real interest in that, and to be patient as you study it, as you go through, because like I said, it's not all found in one place. There's prophecy throughout the entirety of the Old Testament. There's prophecy in the book of Isaiah. There's prophecy in Daniel. There's prophecy in the Psalms and in New Testament in the book of Matthew. First and Second Thessalonians, Revelation. So it takes a while to, you know, dig into all that and put it together. So again, I won't do a full recap of everything that we've done in Daniel, but in the first chapter, something that stands out as important to me, remember that Daniel was a young Hebrew teen, and he was taken captive into this pagan nation of Babylon under the rule of this ruthless king, Nebuchadnezzar, that we've read about. And he was recruited into this three-year program that was essentially a boot camp on how to become a leader in Babylon. And things were very, very different in this new land than the land where he had come from, the area around Jerusalem. The gods that they followed there wasn't the god that Daniel followed. And the reputation that King Nebuchadnezzar had, many people could understand or even justify a bit of compromise in your walk. But Daniel didn't do that. He didn't compromise in the big things, and he didn't compromise in the small things. And as you learn more about this guy, you could see, even today, if we make it that far, a scene where it's like, well, how big a deal would it be if I just did this one thing? I mean, it'll take 10 minutes and be over. And I know several people that compromised for 10 minutes, and that it's changed their life forever. So even as we'll see tonight, these guys are in a situation where it literally could be saving their bacon. Well, not these guys because they're kosher, but saving their lives by the decision that they make. One verse that we read in chapter 1 that stood out to me is verse 8. And it doesn't look like I have it. Why? All right. Let me check something. Okay, well, verse 8 in chapter 1, you guys can turn back a page, says, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, but he purposed in his heart ahead of time. He made a decision that he wasn't going to compromise in that area. Something's out of order here, Jim. Anyway, in the second chapter, the king, Nebuchadnezzar, had this dream, and that dream troubled him. He had that dream over and over again, it appears, and it kept him from sleep. So he called for all the wise men of the land to come to him and presented them with this completely unreasonable, impossible task. Anybody remember what that was? Yeah, not just tell him what the dream meant, but tell him what the dream was. So, unreasonable, impossible task for any man to accomplish. And as you said, he demanded that they tell him what the dream was with no hints or clues, and then tell him what it meant. They said, their response was that, King, nobody has ever made a request like that, because there's no one on earth that could do such a thing. The one thing that they did get right was in verse 11, it says, it's a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Actually, I said they got that right, but they really didn't, because it wasn't the gods that could reveal the dream. It was the God, the only true and living God. And that's to who Daniel appealed. So the king ordered, when all the wise men came and he asked them to tell him that, and they couldn't, the king ordered that they all be put to death. Actually, that they be chopped into pieces, right? And that their homes be burned and made into an ash heap. So when they came to Daniel's house, as they go out and they begin doing these things, and they come to Daniel's house, Daniel asked to see the king. Hey, I wasn't given an opportunity to do this. Let me see the king. And he goes before the king, and he asks for time. He asks the king to give him time so that he could inquire of God both what the dream was and then what the dream meant. And for whatever reason, Nebuchadnezzar granted that request. And Daniel went back to his home, and he and his three friends prayed that God would reveal that dream. So I think that takes us to verse 26. And we might have done some of this. We got to where he was telling him about the dream. So verse 26 says, the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, remember he renamed him, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demonstrated, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. All the wise men that you've called from across the land weren't able to do this. Verse 28, but there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets. So again, not pridefully taking any glory away from God, or that this was of his own ability. There's a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, the secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart. So God actually revealed this to me, not because I'm smarter than anyone else, or he didn't even reveal it to me for the sake of me, but so that you would know. King Nebuchadnezzar, God wants you to understand this. I'm guessing he had his attention at that point. Verse 31, you, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partially of iron and partially of clay. You watched while a stone was cut without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is an image. I know it's small, but you can kind of get that picture. The head was gold, then it transitions to silver, and then bronze, and then there's the legs of iron, and then the feet, you can kind of see that mixed pattern, is a combination of iron and clay. And he goes on to say what this all means. Verse 36, this is the dream. Okay, I've told you what you dreamt. And again, he gets this revelation from God and he immediately starts worshiping before he goes to the king, before he runs it by the king. And then he makes this pronouncement to the king, here was your dream, and then he says, this is the dream. He doesn't ask the king for confirmation. He doesn't, how'd I do? He had all the confidence of the Lord going into this. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. Anybody notice something in the language there? What's that? Yeah, we. He's not one of the, you know, a weirdo that speaks in the third person or any of that stuff. But he's not taking credit upon himself. And it's not just of God, but it's Nebuchadnezzar, this wasn't just me that this was revealed to. It was myself and my three friends that appealed before the Lord in prayer. So don't ever underestimate that ministry of prayer. You know, I think it's probably the most important, or it's certainly one of the most important ministries that goes on at this church, the faithful ministry of prayer. So he says, we will tell you the interpretation of it before the king. Verse 37, you, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And whenever the children of men dwell, or wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. But after you shall rise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes partially of potter's clay and partially of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. Verse 42, and as the toes of feet were partially of iron and partially of clay, so the kingdom shall be partially strong and partially fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. You sense a level of confidence there as Daniel's laying this out before the king. So I'm going to disappoint you a little bit in the detail of this, okay, because we see a picture of this in Daniel chapter 7 that is a lot more detailed, and it's a vision that God gives to Daniel like 40 years from this time of where we are in the book, and that one is really from God's perspective. This is from man's perspective, but just a couple things to note, and you may want to read through this a few times when you get home, because as I just read through it, maybe it makes sense, maybe it doesn't make sense. I think I've got, okay, this image again. You can see there's gold at the top. And what do we know about gold? Is it pure or is it a dirty metal? It's pure and it's valuable, and it's of these metals, it's certainly the most valuable. So the indication there is, two things that are kind of cool is as things go down from the top, they do decrease in value, right? You've got gold at the top, and then you've got silver, then you've got bronze, and then you've got iron and a mixture of iron and clay. So all of those things go down in value, and to some degree, certainly down in value, maybe in purity. But what else do we see? There's kind of a reversal on... When you do iron work, do you pound those pieces with a golden mallet? Why? Not just because you can't afford one, but why? It's soft. It's soft. It's not as strong as, what do you beat it with? Steel. Okay. So most sledgehammers are made out of steel or made out of iron. That's what we use to pound things and break things. You know, but as you get down, there's a reduction in value, but there's an increase in strength in these materials as you go through it. Except when you get to the clay and the iron mixture, there's kind of a mixed strength there. It says you've got some iron and you've got some clay, but the strength of the iron is in it. So kind of the picture that we see, King Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom is linked to the gold because his kingdom, I mentioned last time, he was the most powerful ruler on the face of the earth at the time. And in his kingdom, it was an absolute monarchy. He was the boss and the one and only boss. It wasn't run by committee. He didn't have a war room. He was the boss. And as you go down that, it represents different kingdoms. As you go through history, you'll see that that kingdom was actually defeated. And the other thing is, that kingdom lasted, some people say 70 years. I think historically, if you look, depending upon where you look, it'll say 66 to 70 years. And then some of the other kingdoms that were represented were extremely strong and lasted a lot longer. So you go from the head of gold, which represented Babylon and King Nebuchadnezzar, and then the silver represented the Medo-Persian Empire. And so that was a combined empire. So the leadership was combined. It wasn't an absolute monarchy, and that's sort of the diminishing value of the rule. And then the bronze represented this. So that's why I say it's both a historical book and a prophetic book, because some of these empires have already come, right? So after the Medes and Persians took over, then you've got the Grecian Greek Empire, right? Who led that? Anybody remember? Alexander the Great, right? You know, Alexander the Great, when he was this was all when he was a young man. When he was like 20 years old, there's records of him crying and weeping because there was nowhere else left to conquer. Okay, so the strength of that kingdom and the spread of that kingdom was greater. And then it then transitions into the legs of iron, where it just smashes everything it talks about. And that would represent the Roman Empire, which I think Roman Empire was like 500 years in length of time. So they're inferior as you go down that vision or that dream that he had, as far as a sense of the centralization of absolute power within those kingdoms. Again, Nebuchadnezzar had the greatest amount of power, and it was succeedingly less so as you go down. But they were larger to some degree. They lasted longer than Babylon did. I have some notes here. The Medo-Persian Empire lasted for 208 years, the Grecian Empire for 185 years, and the Roman Empire was nearly 500 years. And then who took over after that? Who would be the feet and toes? That's the prophecy part. It really is, because you look at that and you see 10 toes there, right? And you see this combination of ceramic clay, it says, and of iron. So there's strength there and there's some weakness. And we've seen different leaders and powers come along since then. The Huns, you know, different times Islam, the Holy Roman Empire, Napoleon, Hitler. Anybody think of anyone else? Stalin, you know, but never to the degree of Rome, you know, or these other kingdoms. So we could spend all night right there. So anyways, we'll get into it a lot more in chapter 7, but the idea, I believe, the prophetic picture of defeat are that it would be a united kingdom with 10 leaders, individual areas, and that it would be, people talk about it as being a revision of the Roman Empire. so that that last empire that will be in rule at the time Christ comes back will have come from there and will be a mixture of strength and a mixture of weakness. So it would be a combined, an agreement of powers, probably the closest thing that we have today or that many people would say could rise to that level would be the European Union. You know, I think now they've grown to 23 or something, so it would have to reduce down. But I mentioned in the opening prayer, even kind of knowing where things are going makes the present a little less terrifying. But when we look at that prophetically, I don't see really how the United States could fit that role. So anyways, I'll go into it a lot more in depth in chapter 7. Verse 46, I think, is where we are. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel. What little bit we know about this guy, that was not something that he ever did. But he bows down. He falls on his face before Daniel and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. And he just gave credit to God, just gave glory to God in this. And he, verse 47, the king answered Daniel and said, "Truly, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." So now we've got Nebuchadnezzar acknowledging God, but he's still wrong. Right? Look what he says. Your God is the God of gods. He's not the God of gods. He's the only living, true God. So he says, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. So basically, he made him second to him as far as rule in the kingdom. Verse 49 says, also Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. So notice that Daniel petitions the king and says, hey, this wasn't me alone, but all four of us petitioned God. You know, all four of us played a role in this. So they were appointed into positions of leadership over the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. Chapter 3, verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. What an amazing transition, right? Your God, the God, the God of all gods, the God of all kings, revealed this to you. He bows down and he begins to worship or desires to worship. And then we get to chapter 3 and he starts this building project. The king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. Anybody's Bible say what that is? I think, I'm not a cubit expert, but I think it's like 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. So that's proportionally, that's kind of weird. Proportion. So I don't know, we don't know if there was this big base. I see some of our construction engineers scratching their heads. My house, I think, is 48 feet long this way and 28 feet wide. I can't imagine taking two of my houses and standing them up and having it only be like this wide, you know? So I don't know what it looked like. Maybe like one of the, you know, the things they give out at the Oscars, that tall gold figure. I don't know. Picture your own image. All right. So Nebuchadnezzar immediately starts this building project. He made an image of gold whose height was this, whose width was that. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So calls all of them and come to the dedication of the image. So the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the province gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Verse 4, then a herald cried out, to you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony, with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. So he takes all these people from all over, kind of the coexist thing. Let's just all come together and worship together at the feet of this golden image and bow down before it. Well, I think if you read the Ten Commandments, it specifically speaks about graven images, and not, I won't read through all of them, but not to have any images above God, not to do this exact thing. So, keep going here, verse 6, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And I don't think the herald, it was just a, hey guys, do this, and when this happens, do it. But that verse 6, whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. I think it was on display there and ready to go, ready to be fired up, or was fired up already. So what we have also implied in the scriptures, but not specifically written out right there, was that there were some that didn't bow. There were some that didn't obey the order. We get that from verse 8. It says, therefore, at the time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Seems like you'd get sick of that after a season, you know? But no. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image. I got a problem with this already. Let me back up. Who was it that came and narked on them, the little tattletales? Verse 8, the snitches were who? The Chaldeans. Right, if you were with us in the first chapter and the second chapter so far, they were among the wise men, right, that Nebuchadnezzar called to come and tell him the dream. And then they were like, king, we can't do it. Nobody's ever asked such a thing. That's crazy. You tell us the dream, and then we'll tell you what it means, with no way to verify if what they were saying was right. So he was wise in doing that. But the Chaldeans were of that group that he called, and when they couldn't do it, the order was made that they would be killed, that they would be cut into pieces and their homes would be made into ashes. And why didn't that happen to them? Because Daniel. Because Daniel and these guys prayed to God and he revealed it, the dream. So he told the king and the killing stopped. Stopped killing the wise men. So the only reason why they're alive is because of Daniel. So this worship service starts. They're ordered to all bow down and certain ones don't. And these little weasels go and run right to the king, right? Therefore, at a certain time, Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree. I read that. Verse 11, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs. I don't want to tell you who. But there's certain Jews who you set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. Can you see the temptation when everybody's ordered to do this thing? Everybody said, hey, you've got to fall in line. You've got to do this thing. You've got to follow this order that the king has made, to just do it, to just go along with it. I can see that. I can see it even more when they say, if you don't, you know, maybe you're not going to be able to do this, or maybe we're going to fine you, or maybe, but when they say, if you don't, we're going to toss you in this burning furnace. I mean, what, how long is this going to take? Just like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I'll just bow down, get up. God will understand. Isn't that sometimes a point of compromise? God will understand this. This is a big deal. I'm certainly going to, you know, I can be more effective as a Christian if I live through this than if I die. Certainly God's intent wouldn't be for me to die. You know, but I've been witnessing to this guy in my hut, or I got this blog. Well, they didn't have blogs, but you know what I mean. I've got this thing I'm doing, and certainly I can be more useful if I live. So if I compromise in this small way, but they didn't. King, they don't serve your gods or worship the gold image which you've set up. Verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in a rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, so they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Okay, so if I couldn't understand it before when everybody was doing it, this is a whole different level, because now you're in front of this evil, wicked king. You're in his court now. Is this true that you're not doing that? Verse 15, now, I'm a reasonable man, guys. Now, if you're ready, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony, with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I've made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Can you imagine the pride of this guy? Anybody ever know somebody that's prideful? You've never known anybody this prideful. This was the guy that had the dream. This was the guy that just bowed before Daniel, speaking these things of God. And he doesn't even say, who's going to deliver you from my image, or who's going to deliver you from the gods of Babylon? Who's the God that's going to deliver you from me? Right? Understand, this image was all blatant, not just disrespect, but disregard for the dream that Daniel said, God's revealing this to you because he wants you to know, Nebuchadnezzar. So Nebuchadnezzar looks at that dream, here's the interpretation. He's like, whoa, wait. There's a kingdom coming after me? I don't think so. I'm gonna rule and reign. Babylon's going to rule and reign until the end of time. So let me just redo this image in defiance of God. Let me redo that image, that dream that I had, and make the whole thing gold. All Nebuchadnezzar, all the time. Who's going to rescue you from me, right? Who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. We don't have to debate. Don't bring out the worship team. Don't bring out all those instruments. There's no need to have an argument or a discussion or even a debate on this thing, because back to chapter 1, they've determined in their heart they weren't going this way. They've committed ahead of time. That's not an option. Verse 17, if that's the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. Who? Who's going to deliver us from you? Our God. Our God can do this. He'll deliver us from your hand, O king. Check out verse 18, though. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Now, some people really criticize these guys for this. My God will deliver us. He can. He can do anything. He will, but maybe not. like a Word of Faith church or those type of things? How many of you guys believe God is all-powerful and God can do anything? Anybody ever been in a situation where you're in a trial, you're in a crisis, and you finally get to the point where you tap out and say, okay, this is out of my control, and you pray, and it's like, God, I know that you can do anything, but I just don't know if you will. Yeah. And then there's guilt and there's shame, and I don't have enough faith, and God's not going to do it because I don't have enough faith, and it's by faith that he does things, and doubt sets in, and condemnation sets in that isn't from him. Yeah, that's all we got time. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not going to leave it there. That's a powerful place to be. And I want you to see that, right? Because it says, we have no need to answer you. If that is the case, our God, if you're going to do this, King, verse 17, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O King. I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. We may go straight to heaven. But I want you to know, and I think this is the heart and intent of verse 18, but if not, I want you to know, if we do get tossed into that fiery furnace, because in their mind, I don't think there's any possibility of surviving that. There's no survival if I get thrown into a fiery furnace. There's no survival if I get this diagnosis or that diagnosis or this happens or that happens. There's just no surviving that. That's kind of where they're at. But if it happens, if I get thrown in that pit, it's not because our God couldn't. Our God's got a plan. And something about us getting thrown in that pit must add up to me hearing, well done, good and faithful servant. I've been in a trial where it's like, okay, God, I believe you can. I just don't know if you will. And then maybe he doesn't, or he doesn't on my time schedule. And I know by his word that there's a reason for it and there's a purpose for it. And it's not for my bad, it's for my good. And I might not see it while I'm in it. I want to take a few minutes and get through some of this. I won't keep you too long, but this is important. Because, King, I don't want you to believe this for a second. Let it be known to you, O King, that we don't serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury. I can't imagine it when you learn about this guy. He was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed. Can you imagine? I hope this is one of those scenes that we can see. His whole expression changed towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. The language there is not like, it's 180, multiply it by 7 times, but it was like, multiply it, make it as crazy hot as you can. But even that, it's an example of how bitterness can make us blind. Because if you're a king and you want to make somebody suffer, are you going to crank the furnace up so it's over like that? I'm going to turn that baby down. Slow cook. Let this last, right? But he's so blind with rage, he's not even making sense. Heat that thing up 7 times more than it was usually heated. Verse 20, and he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Why couldn't they have been like the janitors? Why did they have to be mighty men of valor that were going to do this? We'll see. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The guys that bound them, the guys that delivered them to the fiery furnace to pitch them in, the fire was so hot it roasted them. It killed them. Verse 23, these men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down, bound. Again, it says they were bound. That word's in here a couple of times. Into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. You know, and you think, well, that's why he said, if this happens, my God can still do this, but we're not going to survive. I'm telling you, Those poor kids, I don't know what she does. Verse 24, then they can come out if they want. This is good stuff. We're going to go for a couple minutes. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. He looks in, they fall down, they're bound, and he's astonished. And as he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king, true dat, that's what you did. Verse 25, look, he answered, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. That is amazing. So he looks in and he sees four guys, four of them in there, and they're loose. They're no longer bound. So this is a Christophany, an appearance of Christ in the Old Testament, a theophany, a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ in the Old Testament. Just a couple more verses. Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace, and he spoke. He speaks into these guys. Certainly he didn't get too close, right, because the other guys were roasted. He speaks in saying, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God. His language has changed. Who's going to save you? Of the servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire, and the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose body the fire had no power. I want to say one more thing about the statement that they made. My God can do anything. My God can save us from this. My God will do this, but if he doesn't, that condemnation sometimes you get of lack of faith. I want you to see, I noticed this earlier, how God sees these guys, okay? Hebrews chapter 11 is known as what? The faith chapter, the hall of faith, it's called. And all of these people are listed in there, all these amazing things. By faith, Abraham obeyed, and he was called to go out to the place which he would receive an inheritance. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for saving his household. If you flip all the way down to verse 34 I want to look at, but we'll run into it here. And what more shall I say, verse 32, for the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire. Many people believe that, quenched the violence of fire, refers to these guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, specifically, that they're in there, that God saw them as having faith, being faithful. That's a cool thing, comforting for me. 27, the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together. They saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected. You can tell if there's hair singed, can't you? You guys, barbecue guys, you know, you go out to kick a burger and you burn all the hair off your upper body, and there's a stink when you come in, right? There's a smell to that. But the fire had no power, right? He saw the men on whose body the fire had no power. But what else did he see? They were loosed, right? Isn't that cool? They're in there with Jesus. The fire had no power. The hair on their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected. The smell of fire even was not in them. When I go out and do the wood boiler and I come in, I smell like smoke. You know, you sit around a campfire in Maine and you go home and it's in your hair and it's on your clothes. These guys are in this fiery furnace and there's no effect on them. No hair burned, not a hair singed, no smell of smoke. The only thing that happened is they were released from the things that bound them. Verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated. Check this out. Give me like 4 minutes. Can we do that? As we go through this text, another thing I want you to notice, there's no indication. There's the assumption while they're in the fiery furnace that they also see the fourth person. But there's nothing that tells us that they did. They're loosed and they're in there. They hear the king and they come out. And they're unbound. But it doesn't say, they didn't testify of anything. They didn't say of anything. They didn't say, hey, did you see that fourth guy in there? Because sometimes we're in the trial. Sometimes some of you are in trials. And we look at you and you think, well, I don't know how he's going to get through this. Another trial. Well, another trial. How are they going to get through? And it's this. It's Jesus is with them in it. But I've been in trials that don't make sense to me. And I don't understand the purpose in it. And I don't see the value in it. I don't even see Jesus in it. Like, God, I don't know how this is for my good or even for your good. I'm just really struggling here. We don't always see it. They may not have seen it. It doesn't specifically say. I'm not trying to add to the scriptures. It's just something that kind of stood out. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, verse 28, saying, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we'll see next chapter. God gets really sick of him flip-flopping on this all the time. He's awesome. He's not. Who delivered his servants and trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own. Understand, this is the testimony of Nebuchadnezzar. He's the one preaching this right here. This is his testimony. The God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego sent his angel. He delivered his servants who trusted in him. They frustrated the king's word. He's talking about himself. They frustrated the king's word, yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces. Their houses shall be made an ash heap. He likes that, because there's no other God who can deliver like this. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. They didn't preach that sermon, but they did by their lives. Those words didn't come out of their mouths. And I think sometimes as Christians, we feel like, I got to do something. Everybody in my workplace has to know I'm a Christian. I got to wear the Jesus stuff. Or I'm on a Zoom meeting. I'm gonna break out in tongues or something so everyone knows. Or you do something weird. I'm not saying that's weird. In a Zoom meeting, yes. But I'm saying these guys made no statement to the king other than our God can do this. And then they acted in obedience. They did something that put them at risk, but God told them to do something, and they obeyed, and that's the sermon that this king heard. That was the preaching, just their obedience. So we can do dramatic things to draw attention to ourselves and to draw attention to God, or we can just obey. Sometimes that's a bigger way. Sometimes we're asked to do things at work that compromise, or maybe is a gray area, maybe it's a clearly a red area. And you just can't do that thing because of your faith in God. And we ought to be able to say, our preaching ought to have started like the whole year before. That we can say, like these guys could say, O king or O boss, 30 seconds. O king or O boss, what makes me your best employee and your most hardworking employee is my faith. It's my belief in this thing, and this belief prohibits me from doing that, and your testimony up till then is going to preach a sermon like this to the king. All right. God bless you guys. Go get your kids. We're out.